hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.
Bring you some people's history, our history, to look back on, remember, and be inspired by. Around the world, December 10th is Human Rights Day, in commemoration of the date in 1948 that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was adopted by the UN General Assembly. This step proved to be one of extreme importance in the post-World War II world, in coming to see human rights as a global responsibility and not just the internal concern of sovereign states. Here's some history on this date and the Declaration from the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. History of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the UDHR. In the wake of two devastating world wars, the new international community that arose agreed on a strategy for creating universal human rights norms to be shared by all countries, all communities. The Commission on Human Rights, chaired by Eleanor Roosevelt, drafted the UDHR and outlined a vision for an international Bill of Human Rights. This bill, of which the UDHR is the founding document, is also comprised of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. Both of these covenants were adopted within 20 years after the creation of the UDHR. Throughout the rest of the 20th century, various conventions and treaties followed on the vision, specifying the rights of children, women, victims of torture and oppression, and many others. This year, December 10th, 2005, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan sent this message on Human Rights Day. 57 years after the Universal Declaration of Human Rights prohibited all forms of torture and cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment, torture remains unacceptably common. Recent times have witnessed an especially disturbing trend of countries claiming exceptions to the prohibition on torture based on their own national security perceptions. Let us be clear. Torture can never be an instrument to fight terror, for torture is an instrument of terror. The prohibition on torture is well established under international law. It is also unambiguous and absolute. It is binding on all states in all territories under their jurisdiction or effective control. It applies in all circumstances, in times of war as in times of peace. Nor is torture permissible when it is called something else. Cruel and inhuman treatment is unacceptable and illegal, irrespective of the name we give it. States must honor this prohibition and vigorously combat the impunity of perpetrators of torture. Those who conceived of or authorize any form of torture or other cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, and those who commit such acts, should not go unpunished. Nor may any state condone torture by a third party. This means that individuals must never be rendered to another state if there is any danger that doing so may subject them to torture. The international community must speak forcefully and with one voice against torture in all its forms. Today, I call on all states who have not done so to ratify the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment, as well as the optional protocol to the Torture Convention. And I urge all states to allow the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture independent access to detainees within their control. Unimpeded access is an essential protection for these individuals whose isolation makes them especially vulnerable to abuse. Together, we must give voice and redress to abused detainees as well as to all victims and survivors of torture. Humanity faces grave challenges today. The threat of terror is real and immediate. Yet fear of terrorists can never justify adopting their methods, nor can we be complacent about the broader prevalence of cruel and inhuman punishment, which in so many of our societies disproportionately affect the most vulnerable people, the imprisoned, the politically powerless, and the economically deprived. Instead, we must respond to this evil wherever we find it by reaffirming humanity's most basic values. Today, on Human Rights Day, let us recommit ourselves to the principles of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and let us rededicate ourselves to wiping the scourge of torture from the face of the earth. That was a text of UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, his message on Human Rights Day. Another December 10th tradition is the award ceremony of the Nobel Peace Prize. It occurs on this day to mark the anniversary of Alfred Nobel's death on December 10th, 1896. Some amazing people and phenomenal work has been honored since 1901 by this prize. However, one glaring and unfortunate pattern has been the relative exclusion of women from receiving this award. Only 12 have ever been recipients. This is currently being challenged by the 1,000 Women for the Nobel Peace Prize campaign, which was begun by Gabi Vermont-Mangold, an anthropologist and member of the Swiss Parliament, who says she was inspired to launch the campaign while working with refugees at camps in Africa. Here is what the www.1000peacewomen.org site has to say about their project. Millions of women work day in and day out to promote peace. They care for survivors, help with reconstruction, and initiate a new culture of peace. To represent these millions, it is our aim that in the year 2005, 1,000 women shall collectively receive the Nobel Peace Prize for their efforts in pursuit of peace. This political prize will show that the work they do is valuable and exemplary. As their work is taken for granted and is usually unspectacular, it is neither acknowledged nor remunerated. With the exception of 12 women, the recipients of the Nobel Peace Prize, since it was first awarded in 1901, have been men. In negotiating terms of peace, many more warlords than peace queens make decisions about security, reconstruction, and new political structures. This, despite the fact that women constantly prove that with their experience and competence, they can develop and put into practice sustainable peace programs. Our focus is on women worldwide from all walks of life. Women farmer, teacher, artist, or politician, who devote themselves to a future free of violence. They have their own individual origins and backgrounds, which have offered them, as the case may be wonderful opportunities, may be only restricted options. In order that the world become aware of their histories and their work, light must be thrown on their 1,000 profiles. Their 1,000 strategies for constructive conflict management should provide important impulses for conflict research and peace policies. The project will therefore be backed up academically. Last but not least, new peace networks will be established and existing ones strengthened. For your information, the women who have received the prize are Wangari Maathai of Kenya in 2004, Shireen Abadi of Iran in 2003, Jody Williams, coordinator of the International Campaign to Ban Landmines in 1997, Rigoberto Menchu from Guatemala in 1992, Aung San Suu Kyi of Burma in 1991, Alva Myrdal of Sweden in 1982, Mother Teresa, originally from Macedonia, in 1979, Mairead Corrigan and Betty Williams of the Northern Ireland Peace Movement in 1976, Emily Green Balk, an American sociologist, in 1946, Jane Addams from the United States in 1931, and Baroness Bertha von Suttner was the first female recipient in 1905. Speaking of women who've changed the world, December 16, 1901, was the birthday of Margaret Mead, U.S. anthropologist. Here's some information of her from the website www.undelete.org. It's the Women of Achievement and Herstory site. Margaret Mead revolutionized thinking about primitive life and female adolescent sexuality by raising questions about the assumptions of rigid social mores in all cultures. Since her death, efforts are being made to discredit her research by saying she misread primitive tribes' attitude towards females. Simply put, the objectors are concerned that if other societies didn't regiment women to fit men's convenience, then perhaps such regimentation wasn't natural. Her initial findings were summed up in Coming of Age in Samoa, 1928, which is still in print. In 1949, she published Male and Female, A Study of the Sexes in a Changing World, which contrasted gender roles in various societies, the importance of the mother in the development of the children's adult lives, and the different opinions on women's roles. It examined traditional male-female relationships using observations from the Pacific and the East Indies for reference in discussing such topics as the mother's influence in perpetuating male and female roles and the different concepts of women's roles in marriage.
Women should be a priority, respected and upheld in society, given all the proper notoriety, never used or abused by authority figures, like the media that trashes us, play down the hype that constantly bashes our image. TV movies and the videos use women's bodies to create a sick sideshow, too many times seen as a sex symbol, no real intelligence, just a brainless bimbo, not taken seriously for who she needs to be, a human being with the right to be free, not misinterpreted so much of the time, a no means yes, only in a man's mind. Women who struggle and shout take back the night are often viewed by others in the wrong light. The daily violence of rape, don't misconstrue, it is a fact of life, and it could happen to you. You could be walking down the street, a gang of miscreants you happen to meet, high on drugs or whatever the case, they pull a knife, a hole of guns in your face, you cry, yo, can't you see I'm a man, but they just laugh, and get down with their funky scams. You left me wonder, can I still call myself a man, maybe the plight of women you can now understand. And check our herstory, correctly line and define our identity. No more distortion, hear it in a true proportion. Erase the guise of lies that had you dissing me. Check for our past and what we gave humanity. Life from the womb of creation was born the earth, the mother of all habitations, and from her loins the beginning population. Some call her Eve, others call her Lucy. Some try to blame her for the problems of society, but since we know that it was men who wrote the books, perhaps we need to re-examine. Take another look, into Africa, the black land they call Al-Kabla. Here is a story, the teachers of our former glory, of queens and warriors, women strong and brave, refused to be subdued or taught how to behave. They clearly understood the power within comes from God and should not be dictated by men. Some ruled the nation seated on a throne, some led in battle, fight fighting to protect their home. So study nature, science of healing. Religion and the arts reflect their deepest feeling. Music, the list is practically endless. The contributions we have made are quite timeless. In almost every category you will find us singing or playing instruments. Upon the world we make our mark, we make a serious dent. We have influence of sound. We offer soul that nowhere else can be found. Touching of feelings that are rich and profound. Words, let's talk about some writers who use the pen and pages, weapons of a fighter. Educating to the poetry and prose, the essays and the novels and the stories that roll a message with a rhythmical spear into our conscious minds to make us adhere to life and its reality. Uncovering the clouds of mystery, creating hope or fulfilling our destiny. Check out the world, check out your nation. No regret for women is a no-win situation. We got to raise it to an up-iration. Keep your love for women on an airy meditation. Cause women are the teachers and the heroes of the land. Y'all know what I'm saying, so come on and take a stand. To love and protect all the women in your life. Your mother and your sister and your daughter and your wife. Your great-grandmother, significant other. And even all the women you don't know from one another. And the world's gonna be a whole better place. But so much more important, we may save the race. So women should be a priority, women respected and upheld in society, given all the proper notoriety, never used or abused by authority. Women should be a priority, 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 women.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with A Priority.
And now we have Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Leslie Kagan, National Coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, who discusses the changing congressional debate on the Iraq War. Tyson Slocum of Public Citizen, who explains the cause of the spike in energy prices and describes the collaboration of the federal government with energy corporations to boost their profits. And Rob Ritchie, Director of Fair Vote, who talks about Connecticut's new comprehensive campaign finance reform law. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The London-based Guardian newspaper reports the European Union is breaking away from the Bush administration on their global AIDS policy that pushes an abstinence-only agenda. On December 1st, World AIDS Day, the 22 members of the EU released a joint statement on a strategy to fight global AIDS by promoting the use of condoms, needle exchange, sex education, and access to reproductive health services. The Bush administration has pledged $15 billion to fight AIDS over 5 years. However, two-thirds of the funds given out have to go to pro-abstinence programs, and funds are prohibited from going to groups that offer abortion or counseling services. In recent months, AIDS activists have blamed the Bush administration for the growing shortage of condoms in Uganda, the African nation seen as a major success story in the fight against HIV/AIDS. As Stephen Lewis, the United Nations envoy to the African AIDS crisis, lamented, there is no doubt the condom crisis in Uganda is being driven by U.S. policies. He added the Bush agenda is doing damage to Africa. Use of condoms in Uganda has also decreased due to statements by Janet Museveni, the president's wife, declaring that condom distribution encourages young people to have sex. The Washington Post reports the Pentagon is expanding its domestic intelligence operations and looking to conduct its own criminal investigations on terrorism. The Bush White House is considering expanding the power of a little-known Pentagon agency, Counterintelligence Field Activity, which was created in 2002. Based on suggestions by a Presidential Intelligence Commission led by retired Judge Lawrence Silberman and former U.S. Senator Chuck Robb, the administration is working to push the agency far beyond data collection on terror threats to apprehension or detention of individuals suspected or convicted of criminal offenses against the laws of the United States. The Pentagon also wants to allow the sharing of data with U.S. intelligence agencies. Civil liberties groups and some Democrats have opposed the attempt by the Bush White House to expand the military spying on American citizens. As Senator Ron Wyden, an Oregon Democrat, stated, "We are deputizing the military to spy on law-abiding Americans in America. This is a huge leap without even a congressional hearing. Wyden did put a stop to some of the expanded Pentagon power with an amendment to the 2006 Intelligence Authorization Bill. It required a direct request by the military to the Director of National Intelligence, John Negroponte, for any data sharing between the Pentagon, the FBI, and CIA, and a regular report to Congress on military domestic spying work. Greensboro, North Carolina likes to see itself as a trendsetter in the dynamic biracial New South. In the mid-1950s, the city's school board was the first to endorse desegregation after the historic Brown v. Board of Education U.S. Supreme Court decision. However, in fear of riling the Klan, Greensboro didn't actually integrate its schools until 1971. In 1960, Greensboro became a hotbed of civil rights activism when young blacks staged sit-ins at lunch counters at Woolworth's and other department stores. That summer, blacks won the right to pay for food and drink at the lunch counters. However, there is one incident the people of Greensboro do not speak of, the November 3, 1979 massacre of black and white demonstrators by 40 members of the Ku Klux Klan and the American Nazi Party just minutes before a planned Death to the Klan rally outside the Morningside Homes housing project. The rally was organized by the leftist Workers Viewpoint Project. The Klan opened fire on the protesters, killing 4 people and injuring 11. According to Mother Jones magazine, court records later revealed local police had an informant in the Klan to whom they had given a copy of the march route and the march permit. At the same time, a police special agent was at the rear of the Klan caravan but did nothing to stop the violence. Later, 2 all-white juries acquitted 6 defendants. In 1985, a civil jury found the city of Greensboro, the Klan, and Nazi members liable for 1 civil rights violation against 1 demonstrator, and the city later paid his widow $350,000. 25 years later, survivors organized a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to review the incident. The city's white mayor and local law enforcement refused to cooperate. The commission is expected to issue its report in March 2006. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
As the 3rd anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq approaches, congressional debate over President Bush's divisive war is heating up. Representative John Murtha's call for a speedy withdrawal of American forces from Iraq reflected rising opposition to the war as seen in public opinion polls. The conservative Democrat from Pennsylvania's unexpectedly blunt criticism of the war emboldened several Democrats, such as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, to publicly embrace Murtha's message. The Pentagon's recent admission that it had paid to have pro-U.S. stories published in the Iraqi press added to the sense that the White House optimism on the war was simply an extension of a foreign and domestic propaganda campaign. President Bush, reacting to increasing criticism of the war, recently delivered a speech at the U.S. Naval Academy labeled a plan for victory. But the address simply repeated many of the administration's old talking points while touting the progress made toward training Iraqi soldiers. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Leslie Kagan, national coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, the coalition that has had a major role in organizing anti-war protests and lobbying efforts. Kagan reflects on the changing tone of congressional debate on the Iraq war and the task of the peace movement to advocate for a rapid withdrawal of U.S. troops.
Well, I think, to be honest, we still have an uphill battle. It's not like, you know, John Murtha speaks out and all the obstacles that we've had to overcome disappear. These things move slowly and there are bursts of energy and, you know, moments when things break through and you reach a new level of the struggle and of the work. And so I think what's happening is that hopefully more people in Congress are going to find their backbone and feel more empowered because Murtha has stood out there, and continues to stand out there. His positions are very consistent and clear for the last few weeks. So hopefully that will encourage other anti-war, not only Democrats, but some anti-war Republicans to speak out also. And that will, you know, the more that they're speaking out in Congress, the more pressure that puts on the White House. But we cannot, as an anti-war movement, we cannot rely on the United States Congress to do our work. We have got to keep the pressure on, and that means directly on the Bush administration and on the Congress. We have to, you know, move on at those two fronts at the same time. And by put the pressure on, I mean the demonstrations, the marches, the vigils, the civil disobedience, the rallies, all the kinds of ways that we gather, sometimes in small numbers, sometimes in large numbers, but to keep a visible presence out there. And we've also got to find the other mechanisms for making that anti-war sentiment that we know exists in every community of the country much more visible. So, for instance, something as simple as lawn signs. The United for Peace and Justice is producing lawn signs. They should be ready for distribution sometime this week. A simple sign that people can put on their front lawn of the house that says, end the war. People need to wear the buttons. I know it sounds corny, but it actually does make a difference. You begin to change the climate and the culture around you where more and more people can speak out. So we still have a long way to go. This war is far from over, but we also have to, you know, acknowledge that our work is paying off, that we are making a dent, and that if we keep at it, our numbers will grow, and through that process, we will be able to mount even greater pressures both on the Bush administration and Congress.
And what about the president's and many of his allies in the Pentagon, their call for a slow, sure process of what they're calling Iraqization, very similar to what President Nixon was calling Vietnamization back in the Indochina War?
There's no end in sight in the kind of plan that the president laid out. I wouldn't even call it a plan. That's too much of a word. One of the problems here is that they went into this war never understanding what kind of response it was going to generate, that it would generate a resistance and an armed resistance, and people would fight back. They never factored in that after an initial invasion and an initial shock and awe campaign, you know, what the reaction would be from the Iraqi people. They never figured that out. We did not condone or accept or appreciate or like in any way any form of terrorism. You know, we condemn all forms of terrorism, but we don't believe that you fight terrorism by starting a war that's based on lies against people that, in fact, did not commit any acts against you and were no threat. Again, we hold by our call for the U.S. to leave and to bring all the troops home now, to leave immediately. Let me just say one thing. Obviously, when we say leave immediately, no one is naive enough to think that overnight you pull out 160,000 troops and all the equipment and armaments and everything else. When we say immediately, you know, we understand that it takes a little while to move that number of people and that much equipment. But the process has to begin immediately. It can't be, you know, 6 months down the road or a year down the road or when the Iraqis are somehow magically, you know, ready to take care of business and to, you know, to protect themselves.
It seems that the Democrats, generally speaking, Hillary Clinton, who's got presidential ambitions, former Democratic Party nominee John Kerry, and certainly Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman, are either allied with the president directly in the case of Lieberman, or are offering very little difference between themselves and the president's policy in Iraq. What has to happen, you think, to have a real opposition party here that can challenge the president's Iraq policy?
I do think in the short run that people like Hillary Clinton, who is up for re-election this year, you know, in terms of her Senate seat, and is clearly has aspirations to run for the presidency, they have to hear from people. She, for instance, has to hear from people in New York State, her own constituents, but she needs to hear from people all around the country, that we want her to break with the Bush administration on the question of this war. There's a lot of other issues, too, she should be better on, but certainly on this war. And I think people have to keep the pressure on. I should say people also have to keep the pressure on those members of Congress who are even taking a better position and who have come out against the war. They need to know that their constituents stand behind them, because they're going to get pressure from the right wing and from the people who support the war. So we have to keep encouraging them to be speaking out against the war. And in that vein, I would just want to encourage everybody who's listening, take a moment. Call your representative. Call your senators. Even if they already are against the war, call them and say, thanks, you're doing a great job. We want to hear you saying more against the war. Certainly if they're supporting the war, they need to hear from you. And if you can't call, you know, send an email, send a fax, do whatever you can to send a message to Washington.
That was Leslie Kagan, National Coordinator of United for Peace and Justice. Contact the Nationwide Coalition of Peace Groups by calling area code 212-868-5545 or visit their website at www.unitedforpeace.org. After Hurricanes Katrina and Rita battered the Gulf Coast, energy costs spiked, with gasoline rising to more than $3 a gallon. But prices have since come down, now ranging between $2 and $2.25 a gallon. Heating oil prices have seen similar fluctuations, but are still at record levels. As winter approaches, local governments and nonprofit community groups are greatly concerned about the high price of heating oil and natural gas, predicting that low-income families will be facing desperate circumstances long before the heating season is over. Allegations of price gouging have outraged many Americans after big oil companies reported record profits. ExxonMobil had third-quarter profits of $9.9 billion, up 75% and the largest in U.S. corporate history. Together, the major oil and gas companies in the Standard & Poor's 500 index have earned more than $20 billion, up more than 50% from a year earlier. Record energy profits have led some in Congress to call for a windfall profits tax, while others have asked the oil companies to contribute a portion of their earnings to assist the needy. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Tyson Slocum, Director of Public Citizens Energy Program. He explains the cause of the energy price fluctuations and describes the collaboration of the federal government with energy corporations to boost their profits. Companies that, he says, not coincidentally, have since 2001 contributed $54 million to politicians at the federal level, 80% of it to Republicans.
Natural gas and home heating oil prices were on their ways to record highs long before Hurricane Katrina. The hurricane gave cover to a lot of energy traders in New York to push the prices of these commodities well above any previous high price mark. And what that means is homeowners and renters this winter will be facing the highest home heating prices in history. And these high prices are coming at a time of record profits for natural gas and oil companies. And so far, the United States Congress and the White House have failed to provide adequate protections to consumers from these record high prices this winter. In fact, the United States Senate explicitly rejected legislation just before Thanksgiving that would have enacted a new tax on wealthy oil and natural gas companies and used the proceeds to finance an expansion of home heating oil and natural gas assistance for low-income consumers this winter. Public Citizen, along with federal investigations, have clearly documented price gouging and anti-competitive practices by the largest oil and natural gas companies. Those anti-competitive practices directly lead to much higher prices for consumers. And when consumers are paying record high prices, we have also shown that oil companies and natural gas companies are enjoying the biggest profits in their histories. So there's a clear direct connection between the record prices that consumers pay and the record profits enjoyed by oil companies.
So are they doing anything illegal then?
So far, we don't have evidence of illegal behavior. What we do have evidence of are anti-competitive practices that thus far do not violate federal antitrust law, which is why we are calling for strengthening antitrust law to make these types of actions by large oil and natural gas companies illegal.
You've been talking mostly about oil companies. What about natural gas companies and their practices?
For most large oil companies, they have huge involvement in natural gas markets. ExxonMobil, BP, Chevron, Texaco, ConocoPhillips, Shell, they are all the biggest natural gas producers in North America. So when we're talking, and they also are the biggest crude oil producers in North America. So when you talk about prices of oil and natural gas increasing, that benefits big oil companies because they are involved in both oil and natural gas.
If the sharp increase in gasoline prices was due mainly to price gouging and profit taking, then to what do you attribute the sharp drop in gasoline prices over the past month or so?
Well, actually, I think a lot of it has to do with the political pressure that started to arise. I mean, the prices started to drop as soon as Congress announced that the five CEOs of the major oil and natural gas companies would be brought before Congress. The prices started to drop as soon as members of Congress started introducing windfall profits tax legislation that would tax away some of those record high profits.
So are there any other moves in Congress to cushion the price shocks in heating fuel that are expected this winter?
Well, in the Senate has put together a large spending bill. It's Senate Bill 2020 that the senators included two new tax provisions that would increase taxes on the oil industry by about $4.5 billion over the next couple of years. One of the provisions would actually revoke a big tax break that was just passed by Congress in July in Bush's energy bill. So I think that that tax money coming from the oil industry could be used for rebates. But other than that, we're not seeing any other calls for major investigations into anti-competitive practices on the part of oil companies. We're not seeing any calls for windfall profits tax. So in that sense, the oil industry, I think, dodged a big bullet.
That was Tyson Slocum, director of the energy program at Public Citizen, a Washington, D.C.-based public policy organization. Contact Public Citizen at area code 202-546-4996 or visit the group's website at www.citizen.org. In recent months, congressional Republicans have been embroiled in multiple financial scandals, including the indictment of House Majority Leader Tom DeLay on money laundering charges and the Securities and Exchange Commission investigation into possible illegal activities by GOP Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. A federal probe of Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff may well develop into one of the most damaging congressional scandals in recent U.S. history. States such as Ohio, Illinois, and Connecticut have seen mayors, state legislators, and governors convicted on financial misconduct charges. Connecticut's former Governor John Rowland is now serving a one-year prison sentence for accepting gifts from state contractors. Now, after several years of failed reform bills, the state of Connecticut is poised to enact one of the nation's most comprehensive campaign finance laws. The measure, supported by Connecticut's Republican governor, will ban political contributions from lobbyists and state contractors and establishes a system of publicly funded campaigns for legislative races beginning in 2008 and for the election of governor in 2010. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Rob Ritchie, director of Fair Vote, who discusses the strengths of Connecticut's new campaign finance reform law and the flaws which critics, including former GOP U.S. Senator and Connecticut's independent Governor Lowell Weicker, say discriminate against third parties.
It's the result of years and years of activism by some very passionate, well-informed, well-intentioned people who have really should be very proud of this accomplishment, which is, you know, the first time that a state legislature has passed a public financing legislation that covers their own offices. So they are opening themselves up to challenges in their primaries and general elections. And as we know, legislators can be a little leery of doing that. So that took a lot of persuasion, a lot of fortuitous developments. It was unexpected that the governor weighed in as she did earlier this year, and you know, people kept pushing and pushing. And the bill, it's a pretty tough threshold to get public financing, but it's a reasonable one. And so, you know, candidates who have grassroots support and are running within a major party have a very, you know, reasonable chance to get significant funds to run credible campaigns. And there's several provisions that deal with sort of the supply sides, some of the restrictions on giving that I think campaign finance advocates feel very good about. But, you know, the one that I guess I'm most interested in is that this will be a means for candidates who don't have that easy access to money to run credible campaigns, at least within the major parties.
What kind of impact do you think this move on the part of the state of Connecticut will have nationally in terms of possibly being a model of some kind to other states?
Well, it's a real shot in the arm for the public financing movement. There were, victories a few years ago at the ballot box in 96 in Maine and in 98 in Arizona. And then it's been a long time for a win for state legislative offices and gubernatorial offices since then. There were some defeats statewide and some other pushes in state legislatures that fell short, New Mexico and some other states. And I think some of the big funders who had put a lot of money into campaign finance reform had begun to be, you know, thinking that it's going to be too tough to do. But there's been some smart work on this. There were some strong wins in cities. The city of Portland went to a similar system there, and the city of Albuquerque voted it in handily this year. And I think groups are definitely going to try to build on this and see if they can push in other states. There have been some states that have done specific sort of targeted public financing, like for judicial elections in North Carolina and other changes that have been good, but this is the first comprehensive bill in quite a long time.
Now, as for some of the flaws in this bill, most notably, there's been criticism about the provision for public financing that creates kind of a second-class citizen situation for third parties, parties that are not Democrats or Republicans. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it's rather shocking, actually, that at the same time that they could be doing something that I think is as clearly pro-democracy as opening the field to more candidates challenging within the major parties, they put in these really draconian measures that make it pretty much impossible for any third party or independent candidate to qualify for full public financing and very tough to even get any public financing. So in a race for governor, well, basically for any race, but the one for governor is where the numbers are biggest, is you have to get signatures from at least 20% of people who voted in the last race for that office. So if you're talking about a race for governor, getting 20% of the people that voted in the last governor's race to sign a petition saying that they want you to qualify for public financing is an extremely difficult, pretty much impossible task to do. You actually probably would have to get 30% signatures because some signatures wouldn't be valid and so on. And, you know, it essentially means that it wouldn't happen. Lowell Weicker has jumped in to already sue against that or sort of pledging to sue and looking into it. And we've talked to some law professors who have looked at it, and it's pretty much it's a straightforward violation of equal protection. And I think it's founded on this belief that, you know, we don't want those third-party candidates and independents kind of messing things up in general elections. And I think that the whole point of a public financing system is to get new voices in the process, to get new energy, to get some new ideas debated, and that's what our public dollars should go to. It shouldn't just be a means to prop up the major parties. And I think we're learning the wrong lessons from some of the high-profile presidential campaigns of the last few years, Ralph Nader and so on, that Democrats who steered this bill through the legislature probably don't like Ralph Nader much, but the way to handle a third-party candidate is not to discriminate against them, but to accommodate them. And that's what we would like to see a state like Connecticut do: instant runoff voting and look at proportional representation systems that don't try to deny choice in a way that almost certainly is not constitutional, but to try to accommodate it. And that's what these systems do.
That was Rob Ritchie, director of Fair Vote, the Center for Voting and Democracy. Contact the group by calling area code 301-270-4616 or visit their website at www.fairvote.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, the weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, Damon Thomas, and Jeff White. We welcome and need your participation, too. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. That's nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com. You can also live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is new and growing and hoping for your membership and your participation. Go to www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We leave you with this quote from Hans von Spanik, former UN Humanitarian Aid Coordinator for Iraq. When I was in Boston to meet with the editor of the Boston Globe, I was told not to refer, even, to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights or to the UN Charter, because it has no meaning in that newspaper. Well, how terrible, how frightening, when one is warned not to refer to something which is meant to protect us and to give us a better life. He said that in May 2000.